Are you a clinician in primary care who wishes there were better resources to help you understand how to navigate the concept of triage in modern general practice? We'll boost your triage skills with our dynamic 5-session live webinar course tailored for primary care clinicians. Led by myself and Dr. Ed Pooley from Difficult Conversations, this comprehensive training covers all facets of remote patient triage, whether that be digital, on-call, or other opportunities. Through this course, you'll gain practical knowledge, exclusive hints and tips, and direct access to myself and Ed through open Q&A sessions of the course. Elevate your ability to manage primary care challenges effectively and confidently, and most importantly, safely. Register now to transform your triage approach at bit.ly/GP triage course, the GP in capitals, and we will definitely catch you then.
Welcome me, GP learners, to this session where myself and Andy are going to go through the entire GP contract. So this is the imposed GP contract in its final form, and we're going to cover in this episode the GP contract, the PCN DES, all the subsections of that as well, including capacity and access, IIF, and QOF as well. This is going to be a mammoth live stream. It will be sectioned down below if you want to check out the comments and stuff for the timestamps once we've finished it and stuff to help navigate it. But let's get cracking as we tech enhance your primary care. Welcome, EGP learners. How are we doing there, Andy?
Yeah, good. Yeah, a little bit daunted by the task in front of us today to cover all of this in roughly an hour. But hopefully, looking forward to kind of giving people an overview over the documents, because a lot of these are they kind of serve as reference documents. You're never going to remember the whole contents, but you need to know what's in them so that you can dive in and find answers when you need them. I guess that's the approach that I take. But how are you doing this morning?
Yeah, ticking on. Last few days of Ramadan. So one of the reasons why, unlike previous years where myself and Andy section off the various different stuff and things we do in separate videos, just haven't really had the time to do that this year. So we're doing one big stream, but as a result, like I mentioned earlier, do look down in the show notes, particularly if you're looking at this on the YouTube platform where most of that will be stored. There'll be links that show you how to navigate to the relevant sections that you want to check out once we finish the live stream. Give me a few hours and stuff and things to sort that out for you. But we have got a huge, and I do mean a huge amount to cover in this final section. So just to go through what we are going to go through. So we're going to go through the actual GP contract itself and the changes that have happened as a result of this imposed GP contract. We're then going to talk about the PCN DES and the two main sections of that, so Section A and Section B, which we'll come to in a second. We're then going to talk about the capacity and access funding and the changes to that, which are really relevant for your PCNs and particularly practices, because this is where most of the funding that you're going to be able to get for the 24-25 comes from. The changes to IIF and how to achieve them. Then we're going to talk about QOF, and absolutely we're going to take all your questions and comments throughout this episode as well, including that as well. That sounds like a lot, doesn't it, Andy?
It does. Sounds like a lot. So I guess we're ready for about an hour, aren't we? And we'll see how we get on.
Probably. We'll try our best to keep it as quick as we can, though, everyone. And for that reason, let's get cracking, shall we? So first thing we're going to talk about is the GP contract itself. Now, myself and Andy did briefly cover this last week, but we're just going to go into a tiny bit more detail, aren't we, Andy?
Yeah, and it's had a little bit of time to settle as well, hasn't it? I'm just wondering if, Gandhi, it might be worth just showing people where they can find all these documents themselves. Yeah. So so if you go to NHS England, england.nhs.uk, goes to the main website, you click on publications, it lands you basically here in this section where you can search for publications. Probably we want to be looking at ones relevant to general practice. And then it does them in reverse date order, really, and they publish quite a lot. So these documents we're looking at today are on sort of page 1 and page 2 of the current general practice search results. But that's where you find these ones, and you can keep an eye out for things dropping in that area.
So first thing we're going to cover is the actual adjustments, financial adjustments to the GP contract itself. So this was a letter that came out. It's about 4 pages long. And like I said, myself and Andy did cover this briefly last week. We're just zooming in so you can see that a bit clearer. And basically this sets out the terms of the imposed GP contract. Key things to look at is probably that first table that you can see there that showcases the difference in allocations that come through for the GP contract. I guess the key parts that we picked out from this is that there is an increase. So they've included the DDRB uplift for 23-24, which was that 6% rise that was commented back on in round about October, November, but actually worked out about 2.4%, wasn't it, Andy?
Yeah, right. And that was to cover the workforce component of the GMS payment. So it wasn't, you know, a 6% uplift to the whole thing, but if you were giving the relevant employees a 6% uplift in the average practice with average workforce costs, then this should allow you to make that payment. And of course, that's money that came last year. So I guess it's not necessarily, we're going to see that increase this April, are we? I think that's included from last year, we were concluding.
Yeah. Definitely. And then they've included some of the other increases that they've put in, and whether they're actually increases or not. So the PCN funding for leadership currently in the SDF. So this is money that is allocated to PCNs that was at the discretion of ICBs to some degree in terms of allocating. What they've done is included that within the kind of contracting mechanism to say this money should now go directly to the PCNs themselves, which is in addition to the other funding for leadership and oh, I forgot what the term was now, Andy.
There was leadership and management funding, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I think some of it was sort of top sliced and spent at a higher level than PCNs. Well, that was, I think, our local experience, but that looks like it's allocated to go directly to PCN. So whether you can count that as an actual increase or not, I don't know.
Realigning the deck chair, shall we say. Probably is better.
Maybe we're not sat on the Titanic, are we, Gandhi? Is that the analogy? Anyway,
what you think about this moment in time with the general practice and stuff, is it the Titanic? I don't know. But then in addition to that, there is some extra funding they're putting into the IAF, which is specifically around the early cancer diagnosis. They are putting an extra £5 million across the entire contract value. So that's all practices and networks to help with early cancer diagnosis, and we will cover that when we get to the IIF section. And then some smaller baseline growth, and basically what that means is that the total value for the GP contract has gone up to 11 billion.
Million. These are millions. 11,000 yeah. Millions. 11 billion.
Yeah, in total, which is allocated to the general practice out of the total NHS budget of 170 billion, I think it is.
I think it's about that. Yeah.
So, like we said, this is kind of the key financial stuff that people need to be aware of. The next paragraph identifies what we just mentioned about the changes in the leadership funding for the PCNs and stuff, as well as a bit more details to the actual funding and stuff that comes through.
Yeah, reducing IAF from 36 to 5 indicators, that'll be apparent when we look at the IAF section. But there was a drive to, they say, sort of simplify and reduce the bureaucratic burden on general practice. So there's a reduction in QoF indicators and IAF. So it's explaining really the rationale or the facts behind what's behind those figures, essentially.
Yeah. And then it talks about the CAPE funding, which we will come to shortly. But the key thing is that that's continuing. It's still a 70-30 split in terms of 70% straight away for doing the basic stuff that it mentions. We'll cover that when we get to that section. Then the 30%, the main difference being the additional 30% is available in financial year compared to the 23-24 additional 30%, which practices will probably start getting in the next month or two from previous years and stuff. And we'll go through the criteria you need to go through in order to achieve that. And then, yeah, just tying up a few extra things. So there's the weight management, which is continuing at 7 million and the resources to that. We mentioned last time around that we're not going to go into that in any real detail because it's basically the same thing. There's no difference. And then the changes to ours, which talks about the increase in funding, which is basically just a baseline increase of 2%.
2%, I think.
Yeah. And obviously the inclusion of the enhanced nurse access role that's available. Which so I've been sent some really helpful information from some EGP learners, in particular trying to look at that. We unfortunately aren't going to cover that in too much detail, but effectively just a reminder, enhanced nurses is basically you've got your practice nurses here, you've got your ANPs there, and you've got your consultant level nurse practitioners up here. And the enhanced one is kind of in between practice nurse and an ANP. In terms of experience / qualification / capabilities, and it's more focused on particular areas and things. So that's kind of our understanding of it. Feel free to tell us if we're wrong in the chat and the comments.
Yeah, And as with anything, we've not done the disclaimer, have we? But, you know, we're not your ICB. We don't manage your contract. Yep. We're not locally interpreting how you're performing to the contract. So always have these discussions with your local ICB about what their expectations are about your delivery. And I think with the enhanced nurses, I think my understanding was that it was the intention is to allow the employment of nurses to do sort of additional specific things that aren't practice nurses and that aren't seeing minor illnesses or the sorts of things that AMPs would do, but are additional sort of in the spirit of the principle of primary care networks, that funding is for additional non-core general practice work. So that was my interpretation.
Yeah, pretty much agree with that. And then pretty much it talks just mainly about the ARS reimbursement from there on, wasn't it, Andy? I can't remember there being much else.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's flexibility. They've removed the caps on roles, I gather. And there was the addition of the enhanced. Was there any other additional roles? There was the enhanced nurses.
No.
I think we covered that in more detail previously. So that was the letter, essentially. Mm-hmm. So
next thing we're going to talk about is, I guess, what does that mean? So obviously we talked about the changes to the GP contract that have come through. So there's the 2% overall uplift that came through. There is some of the minor changes in terms of data sharing agreements and various other things. I would highly recommend go back and look at our previous episode where we covered all of that. But one of the things that we wanted to talk about now was more specifically, it was the changes around the PCN DES itself and go through what that actually means for practices. Because the key thing with the PCN DES is that's where all the additional funding seems to have gone through for practices, which also includes the capacity access improvement funding, as well as the IAF, and then we'll go to QAF after that. So, shall we start with the PCN DES, Andy? Do you want to know how to use System 1 more effectively as a clinician? There are various different things you can look at, but there is only one course that can help you understand this and have all my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, and that's the System 1 course for clinicians. If you want to have a look at it, have a look bit.ly/TPP S1 course, TPP and S1 in capitals. But if you do have a look at it, what will you get? Well, you'll get content and information and guides on how to use System 1 more effectively, from getting started with System 1 to navigating the patient record, to understanding the key parts like doing a consultation, as well as prescribing, clinical admin, communication, and various other information. And this includes my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, so it saves you time and your patients stress in terms of their navigation with their patient journey. If you want to have a look at it, check out the link. As I said, it's bit.ly/TPP S1 course, and the TPP and S1 are all in capitals, and you will get access to all this content perfectly. Even better yet, there's a money-back guarantee. So if you don't actually find this course has helped save you some time, just let me know. I'll refund you the course once you've completed it and stuff. Catch you then.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. So how the PCN DES is structured has changed this year. So previously we had sort of one large document. So this is the document from last year, and within that it provided sort of sections to look at the so section 8 is a big section that's changed. So that's the section that looked at the service requirements, and there were quite a number of things in section 8 within the main document. Let's just remind ourselves, gosh, so much text to scroll through. So there was the SMRs, medication reviews, meds optimization work. There was the enhanced health in care homes work and specifications in there. There was the early cancer diagnosis work. There was social prescribing. There was specific requirements around cardiovascular disease prevention, tackling neighborhood health inequalities, anticipated care, personalized care were in there. So the contract's changed. So they sort of said they're simplifying things. So this contract weighed in at about 115 pages. So there's a new main contract that weighs in about 120 pages. And then there are two guidance packages that are, so there's part A, looking at the clinical requirements, and it's guidance for implementation. So I think when we get to that, I think we can interpret that as guidance rather than specifications. That's my interpretation. And then there's part B, which is guidance around the non-clinical implementation of the contract. And so the total of everything now is 206 pages. So sort of simplified to 206 pages. That's interesting.
Well, that's the NHS, isn't it, for you, Andy? When we simplify things, we make them bigger and more bureaucratic.
Yeah, although actually the guidance documents are helpful. And when we get to them, you'll see that they actually link out to resources that might be useful in the implementation of it. And, you know, sometimes, you know, the lack of guidance is difficult, isn't it? Because there can be disagreements with ICBs, PCNs about what needs to be done, and there can be disagreement, you know, or there can be confusion about how to do it. So actually some of those links and resources are really, really helpful. So if we look at the content of the main document now, this,
can you just zoom in, Andy?
I can, yes. So helpfully, if you pick up the new documents, they've highlighted bits in orange or yellow, which my highlighting is a slightly different hue of yellow here. But you'll see the different shades of yellow, which I think are drawing our attention to things where there've been sort of significant changes to the wording or the content. As per the previous document, these have largely become, I think, reference documents to me. It's difficult to, you won't remember all of the specific contents, but being familiar with the content, with the contents pages at least, so that you know what is in them and you can dive in and you can answer questions or queries if you're wondering about how to implement certain things. The PCN DES is largely the manual for running the PCN. So a lot of the information is about how practices sign up and how you should elect your clinical director and, you know, things like that, which I think have been embedded for a lot of primary care networks now. So just highlighted a few bits that we might want to draw attention to. I think we've already spoken about the changes to the additional roles reimbursement scheme. I think the main changes in previous videos, the service requirements might be worth looking at. So it's still Section 8, but it's a lot shorter now. And actually Part A provides the guidance for the implementation of this. But they sort of do define the four key functions of a primary care network, which I think is quite interesting. So coordinate, organize, and deploy shared resources to support and improve resilience and care delivery at both PCN and practice level. So there might be a bit of improved sort of clarity about what a PCN is for now, because it was all things to all people initially. And was it to support core general practice? Was it to work on population health management? These things were a little bit unclear. So they do define the core functions. So we've done A. B, improve health outcomes for its patients through effective population health management and reducing health inequalities. So that's up there as a main requirement. Target resources and efforts in the most effective way to meet patient needs, which includes delivering proactive care. And D, collaborate with non-GP providers to provide better care as a part of an integrated neighborhood team. So that's now specifically detailed in the PCN DES. So this is an area, as you can see with their shade of yellow, that has changed somewhat. So and then these areas are talked about more. So supporting improving resilience and care delivery and improving health outcomes and reducing health inequalities, they're talked about in Part A. Part A is the guidance for this section 8 of the contract. I'm just whizzing us back to the top. There's probably a button on this interface that takes us back to the contents page, but I can't find it. And then there's the network financial entitlements as well, which, again, there's a handy table that just highlights where these have changed. I think we've already talked to these, but it just highlights the headline levels of funding that are now available in terms of core funding per patient, the enhanced access payments, the care home premiums, which remains at £120 per bed, and the capacity and access payments as well.
So if we just go back up to the top of that table, I think probably worth us just covering that in detail so people are aware of it. It's obviously based from April 1st, 24 to 31st of March, 25, £2.916 per patient with £2.218 multiplied by the registered list size from the 1st of January, 24 and £896 multiplied by PCN adjusted population as of 1st of January 24. And this combines the funding that previously they had as core funding and director payments and leadership and management payments. So we mentioned earlier about that 44 million and the other funding being rolled into things. That makes up the 89 million in total that is now available to networks directly. So basically they've taken the £1.50 that we got before and added in this extra pot that is now at the network's discretion to use, compared to before it was much, there was additional stringencies, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah. So we always used to think of this as the £1.50 we used to talk about. But obviously, as you say, the clinical director funding and the leadership and management funding has been rolled in, and that can be used flexibly. So it might be that you need two clinical directors, and you know, you can now do that within the funding. It might be that you need no clinical director because you've got some strange structure. Not advocating for that, but less than you had before, and you have the flexibility now to use that funding for other things or other kind of management or leadership posts within the primary care network. So they're trying to increase the flexibility there. I don't know anything else on the table worth specifically talking to. Obviously, it's all then people can dig in.
Well, the enhanced access wasn't one of the things that was included in the overarching specification. They had to keep that separate because they felt they hadn't had enough time to evaluate that as to how it will look. And that continues at £7.674. By the adjusted population. Worth remembering there are effectively three different population stats that they use when it comes to PCN DES. So you've got your raw list size, you've got your weighted list size, and now you've also got your adjusted patient list size as well, which is where a lot of the PCN payments come through. And then as Andy mentioned, you've got your £1.20 per registered care home bed in your network for the care home premium, which requires the reviews, and it's relevant to those specific codes and things. And then it talks about the CAPE funding, which we'll come to in a little bit more detail shortly. So, quite a few things in there, isn't there, Andy?
Yeah, it's a big document, but as I say, be familiar with what's in it, know where to find the contents page, and you can dig in and find what you need when you need it. So that's the main DES, and then it breaks it out into two guidance documents. Mm-hmm. And they do say guidance, and within these documents, they use words like could and should and can. So it does read like guidance rather than that these are actual specifications that need to be followed. So part A, this supports section 8, and if we look at what's in it, it's broken down into what, you know, what the main requirements are now. So improving health outcomes and reducing health inequalities and targeting resources and efforts effectively. And then it does talk about the enhanced access in here as well. So if we just move through, so they're being clear that this is
can guidance. Can you zoom in a bit, Andy?
Zoom out a little bit. I've got a huge monitor next to me, so if we go too far it looks enormous to me. So guidance package designed to support the commissioners and PCNs and the practices to do these. So part A and B are guidance packages. It just links this back to the four key functions of primary care networks, so that starts to appear in a number of places. We've already spoken about those earlier. So part one is improving health outcomes and reducing health inequalities. So it talks about how a PCN can do this in collaboration with other parts. And actually, this document refers back quite often to the Core 20 Plus 5 framework for improving. I've got that queued up to show you somewhere, but I've got too many things open. But for Core 20 Plus 5 is basically the framework for improving health outcomes in, you know, the adult population. They have a Core 20 Plus 5 for children as well. I'm just jigging my screens around. Let's bring this over and Core 20 Plus 5. So this will be familiar to people, but it's looking at improving maternity care, severe mental illness, SMI, chronic respiratory diseases, improving early cancer diagnosis, and cardiovascular disease through a focus on hypertensive case finding. And that's the core five conditions, and then the 20 is a focus on the 20 most people living in the sort of 20% of most deprived populations or circumstances. And then the plus is particularly looking at people who might be disadvantaged or have difficulty accessing care. So we could talk about health inclusion groups, so maybe homeless or certain ethnic groups. So just showing that just to indicate that they mentioned this in a few places in the document. So they link across to those principles. So there we go. So it talks about how PCNs can work together with their ICB and with other parts of the local health economy to engage in population health management. It links out to lots of documents about what good population health management looks like and how to use data. And they say, so should consider applying population health management approaches, expected to engage proactively with wider partners, including secondary community care, mental health services, ICB, and to have data sharing agreements with those organizations to help support this work, to have a focus on being data driven, and they provide lots of links to things that can help with learning to how to do that effectively and access the right sorts of data. More principles that can be applied. They don't necessarily talk about the outcomes. So I think the outcomes are to be agreed, you know, locally in collaboration with those partners in terms of what that actually looks like. Health inequalities. So we're talking, they're saying that they link it back to the DES specification that PCN should actively seek to reduce health inequalities across the core network practices in line with guidance and the core 20 plus five approach. So we're linking back to that. They talk about collaboration with local communities. Again, they're suggesting and strongly steering towards focusing on core 20 plus five principles, but they're not stipulating specific outcomes. So I think these are to be agreed in collaboration with PLACE and ICB. They also talk about supporting the CVD prevention and diagnosis efforts. So this is where we've got a table that so to achieve this, there are practical actions and steps that PCNs can. So that's that, could, can, should language. And they give some tips about how you can improve detection and management of CVD. So they talk about opportunistic, targeted case finding for hypertension. So they talk about things like targeting people who are in at-risk groups who haven't had contact with practices for some time, doing BP checks and the also AF, doing AF checks in places that aren't practices, so outreach activity. So there's guidance and steers to do this sort of work. Similarly, they're talking about identifying people with elevated cholesterol, raised lipids, or raised lipids that aren't managed optimally, and a particular focus on identifying people with unidentified familial hypercholesterolemia. And there's also a focus on heart failure, and they're largely talking about encouraging and supporting practices to use BNP, brain natriuretic peptide, in people at risk of heart failure or with suspected heart failure, to identify those people, get them to have an echo or further diagnostic tests, and start them on their management. So that's that. Shall I pause there for a second, Gandhi? Any reflections so far?
So definitely some information there. I think, like Andy mentioned, this is the repackaging of the original cardiovascular DES kind of plan that we talked about almost 3 years ago, I think it was. So there hasn't been any major changes in that respect. So a lot of this was stuff that, you know, networks were already doing as part of IAF and various other things that obviously that they've now been reconciled into different pots for the funding for it. But this is now part of the work that networks are either can do or should do, and the language does adjust to some of that. So Andy said originally it says can do this, but then if you notice in the table it went to should partway down as well. So
yeah,
being aware of the language I think is important here.
Yeah, so it's kind of somewhat conditional language, but networks do need to be doing something in each of these areas that are specified. I guess moving on with a little bit more pace, they there's a section on early cancer diagnosis. So there is a requirement to do something in that area. And this talks about how you might do that. And it talks about focusing on referral pathways and practices across core practices. And it talks about improving screening. It particularly talks about working with cancer alliances. And it does say alliances have been allocated funding to support this work. So they have been, it says allocated funding to engage with primary care networks and practices to support this activity. And there is a particular focus on FIT tests and colorectal cancer, and that's mentioned here, and that's also part of the remaining IIF. So there's lots of underlined documents and websites and sources of information to really help practices implement this. I guess if I was still sort of a CD working in a primary care network, I'd be thinking about who I was delegating this work for. Managing a primary care network is so huge now, isn't it? That I think it helps to have a cancer lead or a lead for cardiovascular or a lead for population health management would probably allow you to cover all of these things. What do you think about practically implementing this stuff, Gandhi? What are your thoughts just kind of beginning to digest?
Well, as we go through the different criteria, I mean, I think it's important that you have some focus on this aspect, and also keep it as part of your PCN meetings themselves as to how you're going to look at it, how you're going to address it. There will probably be some form of return that still comes through. So at the moment, every network has, every clinical director and their team has to do a return back to NHS England to say how they've achieved each of these criteria. We need to see what next year's return looks like, whether it's one big overarching one like this should be, or whether it's going to be still individual composite ones that we have to put to a bigger report and stuff. But basically, it does need to be on your agenda. I know from my point of view, a good person to look at for that is Tara, our friend from, the Business of Healthcare podcast and stuff. And actually, Tara's joining us apparently, watching us in bed and stuff today. And we're going to be seeing Tara in a couple of weeks, actually, our PCM Plus conference and stuff, where we'll probably be talking about some of this things as well. But definitely check out their website. They've got some really great resources for you to look at that give you a reminder of these are the things to look at each quarter, each month and stuff, to keep track on some of this kind of stuff, as well as tips and examples of what other people are doing across various different areas and things. So that's what I would look at to help remind you what you need to be doing if you're a PCN clinical director watching this right now, which it seems like we've got a few.
Good. So we'll get through the rest of this this part, A really highlighting what's in it. The structure of it is, it for each section, it sort of makes state it links it back to the DES. So for proactive care, the first statement normally says what the PCN must do, and then in quotes it quotes from the main contract document. So here, with regards to frailty, the DES specification states that PCNs must contribute to the delivery of multidisciplinary proactive care to those complex patients at the greatest risk of deterioration in hospital admission by risk stratifying, and it goes on, and then it says to achieve this, PCNs should, so it says how you might go about this. So here, with regards to frailty, it's talking about having a mechanism to proactively identify and code patients with frailty, so that these people can then be offered specific interventions and provided with care plans to reduce their risk of hospital admission and deterioration, for example. And then it talks about structured medication reviews. So this was part of the previous Section 8 in last year's document. And much of this is evolved. They've said they've simplified it, but actually there's a lot of things that are still there. So this talks about that they must deliver structured medication reviews to high-risk cohorts, so I don't think that's changed particularly. And then it talks about what an SMR is, and which particular groups might benefit from an SMR. Again, it's linking it to say it should also be alert to the needs of communities and individuals at particular risk of health inequalities, e.g. core 20+5, and also BAME and learning disability groups. So it's linking it back to the core 20+5, so that's beginning to feature much more prominently in the documentation. Talks about what an SMR is, so it's useful to have that guidance. Talks about collaboration on wider medicines optimization. So that's working with your ICB pharmacists and so forth. Talks about net zero, talks about STOMP, all of those things that we've been doing over the past few years in addressing polypharmacy. And then social prescribing, that was also part of the old Section 8, that is here as well. And it talks about what social prescribing is and who that should be provided to. And I think most primary care networks are probably putting that in place mm-hmm. at the moment. It again has this line to consider core 20 plus 5 when mm-hmm. sort of selecting cohorts who might particularly benefit from SMRs. Social prescribing. And then this is where also you have your details around the enhanced health in care homes. And sort of reading through, this sounded very, very similar to the previous specification around enhanced health in care homes. Do have a read through yourself, but that sounded very, very similar. And then also talking about the enhanced access. Again, I think that sounded very similar as well to me. And then it just talks about some of the coding to use there. So that takes us to the end of part A. I don't know if we've got any comments, Scandi, that we want to go to.
Well, we've had a few, so I think we will go to that. Just before we do that, I just want to point out, and I did this last time, so we've got over 100 people joining us live on a Saturday morning. So shout out to all of you GP learners who are doing that, because, over 100 of you. That's amazing. That really is. But yeah, in terms of comments, we've had a few. So where are we? So Francis Mulhern, let me just make this that way so it's a bit easier. Do you think the DES gives us an indication that PCN will be devolved into integrated neighbourhoods? Will the new funding process for PCNs in the future? So I think this is what people assumed would happen this year, and it didn't. That networks would change into neighborhoods or something like that, potentially. Now, the reasons for that is probably because we're anticipating there's going to be an election in the near future, and therefore nobody wants to make any major changes. I find it really frustrating that because of that process, everything's kind of stopped, let's be honest. The entire process has stopped itself, and that's challenging. But yeah, does this mean that we'll be moving more towards integrated neighborhood teams? Well, in Section B, which we'll come to, it does mention one line in there about moving more towards neighborhood working and things. So I think this is possibly the direction of travel, and that's what PCNs have possibly been created for. Don't know what you think on that, Andy.
I think so. I mean, quite how different an integrated neighbourhood team might be from a PCN. I think that's up for debate, isn't it? I think it's. I'm not sure there is a well formed universal idea of what an integrated neighbourhood team is at the moment. And people talk about integrated neighbourhood teams and integrated neighbourhood working, and are they the same thing? So, yeah, it's a complicated question. I think PCNs will continue to evolve. So I think in a few years' time, they will look different. And I think we've seen over the course of the last 5 years, what PCNs delivered has become more complicated, and there's more responsibility and activity happening at PCN level. So if that becomes something that we might call a neighborhood team, I think that will happen.
Mm-hmm. Possibly. Joseph makes the comment about some CDs are concerned that their funding is no longer ring-fenced and practices might argue about their payment. I think it's a valid point, Joseph. I think that comes down to how good the CDs are at communicating with their practices and also how much work they're actually doing for them. I'd argue that the amount of work that clinical directors are doing for the networks, it has never been appropriately funded because it's considerably more than what the funding allows. But at the same time, you need to be showing that to your practices as well and explaining it to them. So therefore, there's absolutely an element of communication to go through. Does that mean that the practices could determine where that funding goes? And like Andy said, maybe you may be in a network that doesn't need a clinical director anymore. Please don't let there be Nottingham City East, because otherwise I'm out of a job. But at the same time, I think there is that flexibility that comes through, which is actually quite welcome in some ways, of being able to say, like Andy mentioned, maybe you could have a health inequalities lead for your network, maybe you could have a population healthcare lead for your network, and you've now got a bit more flexibility to drive that through with the funding. Andy?
I think a lot of there are some primary care networks that have like very different structures to what we might typically conceptualize a primary care network to be. You know, there are primary care networks that share their footprint with that are a one practice primary care network, for example. Mm-hmm. And it might be that having one clinical director doesn't suit them because they already have a leadership structure in place and they don't need that, but actually they would need delivery leads for different elements of the primary care network. So I guess that, you know, the flexibility is probably welcome. It might be that if you are doing more than your, you know, allocated 1.5 days a week, that you can advocate for some more funding for the clinical director as well. You know, the removal of the ring fence might facilitate those discussions as well. Good point.
I am going to point out clinical directors have not received a pay rise throughout most of the terms of the contract as well. So just something to consider.
Maybe support that from core funding. Maybe.
John Henderson, do you get a sense that some of the PCN targets don't coordinate well with the QoF targets, example, CHD? It's interesting. I think some of the targets did and some of the targets don't. And there has been some disparities between them, particularly when we had the IIF targets previously. I think there was more synergy. That seems to have gone a little bit to the wayside since last year with the CAPE funding coming through and things. But I think it does vary, unfortunately. Andy?
I mean, we can probably talk more about that when we get to the QoF, and we'll have gone through the IAF at that point to get everyone on the same page. But it's difficult.
And then Christine has asked a question about 2.1.11 early cancer, working with partners, who? Pharmacies? I think pharmacies is an option. I probably see more community services, Macmillan Trusts, I guess those kind of things when it comes to cancer screening, public health as well, because it's more about trying to encourage patients to involve themselves with the access and that kind of thing as well. So that would be my perspective. Christina's also come through from another one. Appendix B 7.2.1 re-ARS max entitlement. Anyone had a notification already for 1/4/24? I'm not quite sure which notification you mean, because I can't remember what line that was. Was that about possibly being over your allocated budget, I would think?
Appendix B...
7.2.1.
Appendix B 7.2...
Let's have a little look at it, shall we?
I'm on it. Appendix B 4, 5, 6.
So it's 7.2.1.
7.2, so it must be within here. So we're 7.21, so that's 7.2A, do we think? I think we're in the wrong place, aren't we?
Unless it's I, point I.
Effective shared decision making. I think we're in the wrong place. So maybe we'll come to that. Maybe it's in part B,
possibly
clinical guidance.
Let's see. Christina, yeah, just explain that in a bit more detail so we can understand what you mean. Apologies on that. And yeah, so Francis, last comment, and our 2% increase to support all of this is laughable. Yeah, I think many people feel that obviously the increases have not been commensurate, I think, to what we probably feel we need. And we talked a lot about in the previous episodes as well. So I know the BMA looking at that in detail as well.
Yeah, although this is the PCN DES, isn't it? So 2% core, yeah, core contract. The PCN DES is, ARS has at least gone up by 2%, but they have simplified some of what the requirements are. Mm. So it's not that the 2% from the core contract is to support this, I guess. I'm just being fair to everybody in explaining that.
Okay.
Christina said it is the Part B guidance, non-clinical. So we'll have a look at the content of that next.
Yep.
I'm aware that the timekeeping is a bit dreadful today, Gandhi, so we'll try and get to this a bit quicker.
Let's go to section B then, shall we?
So hang on.
Just waiting for Andy to switch that over. So I guess so the section B is the non-clinical guidance around the PCN DES contract. And as Andy zooms in, you'll see there's quite a few things that have changed. Not as much as I guess you would anticipate normally. I was expecting more, but yeah.
A lot of this is guidance on the bread and butter of kind of running the primary care network. You know, how do you sign up? You know, how do you re-sign up? You know, what are the criteria for forming a primary care network? And, you know, all of these things, really. It's 69 pages. I think we can just zoom in on a few areas, really. So we talked about how now the clinical director role is more tightly defined. And this is the section. It's quite short, essentially. It says who the clinical director should be and what the requirements are. So that's interesting. Do you have any comments about that, Gandhi? Or
just no, really? I think was this the part where we mentioned about INT working? I can't quite remember where that was.
It's about modern general practice, they mentioned, because supporting practices to move to modern general practice was this concept that was came through when the last year's contract was imposed around equality of access, be that through the telephone, be that through an online method, or be that walking up to the desk face to face. Everybody should receive the same service and same access, and they should receive some sort of
which
response
we'll come into in a second.
So
we'll come to that in a second. But key part of the changes is that it's the PCN clinical director's responsibility to make sure that modern general practice is achieved in their network area.
Yeah. So that's better defined. It's a reference document, isn't it? So if you're thinking, we need to subcontract something to a physio service provider or pharmacy service provider, you know, how do we go about that? This is where all of that guidance is to kind of dig in and get some more information about it. Look at the main contract, and then there's expanded guidance within this document. Things had changed around the additional roles reimbursement scheme. I think we've spoken about that already in previous videos, so it may be that we don't zoom in on that.
No.
The financial entitlements, I mean, we've actually had a look at a table there as well. So maybe
I think it probably is worth just looking at it briefly.
It's similar information to what we've already covered, I think.
So just a reminder, if you wanted to look at the full summary of the financial entitlements for the PCNDES, this is the key section. So the one we looked at was just kind of like the overview letter. This is the full breakdown of what each network should have and is allowable to receive and stuff. So worth having a look at that if you're looking at the financial side of it. I think
there's a Ready Reckoner, isn't there? Is it worth talking about the Ready Reckoner at this?
Probably, yeah. So I guess with the contractual change, there is a Ready Reckoner that practices can have access to. This is actually in the GP contract letter container on an NHS England's thing. So it's a downloadable Excel form that you can see here, and basically put in your network and your practice details, and then this will give you the outputs of what funding you're eligible for and all the other kind of things. So this is something that's been provided previously. I guess one of the things I would always try and check the data, my experience with the Ready Reckoners from NHS England has been they've not always been 100% accurate, and they don't adjust in year either, so obviously you need to make sure you go back and get the correct version as well, but it's a useful document to plan with and stuff. But I think the key things that we wanted to look at on this section in particular was one of the big changes that's now been formalized, which is the capacity and access payment, isn't it, Andy? So I'm just going to go through this in detail. So some of you will remember that we did the live streams on these previously. A lot of the criteria is still the same. I guess the key difference is that for this financial year, for 24-25, that's come through, is that they have increased the amount of funding that's available for the capacity and access improvement funds. So they've added in an extra, and I've forgotten the number, Andy, apologies, was it some...
I can't remember, was it 55 million or something
like that. Which is reconciled from the IAF criterias. So IAF has gone down from being 6 criteria now down to 2. And as a result of that, those funds have been reconciled into the capacity and access improvement funds. It still continues under the 70-30% split, and we'll break down those splits in a second. But it's important to be aware that this is regular and recurrent funding that's going to come through for the next few months at least. We don't know what's going to happen after March 25, but at least for the next year, this is funding that will be coming through directly to the practices. It works out, depending on your population size, about £15,000 a month that comes through on the 70% split. I know the more specific details there. Sorry, 13,000.
For average PCM, which I think is probably roughly just under 50,000. I think about 47,000 is the average PCM size.
And then it talks about the local capacity and access improvement payments. So this is the 30% you may have heard people talk about. A reminder that this part of the funding will be coming to primary care networks in quarter one of 2024, so in the next few months, and that's based off last year's achievements. This year's achievements is payable in year. It's £1.392 per registered patient. Adjusted population patients. And I worked out that for a 50,000 population practice, that's about £69,000 if you were to get all of the 30%. Key things to know about this, and there's a couple of key points. Number one, you don't have to have achieved everything in order to get the payment. It's split into three different parts further. And he's just scrolling down to it. So there we are. So it's the three criteria of better to the digital telephony, simpler online requests, and faster care navigation. So for the telephony, as long as all of your practices have moved over to better purchasing framework provided telephony routes, then you will get the 10% of that. So, you know, what's 30% of 69,000 if you're a 50K population? We're talking about 20K.
23. I think you're right.
Okay, yeah. So just to summarize again, assuming you're a 50,000 patient population in primary care network, per 10%, you'll roughly get about £23,000. So for the better digital telephony, if you've done that in year, your primary care clinical director can say that you, the, all the practices have done that, you will get roughly £23,000 for the network. To do the simpler online requests, you have to be providing online consultations towards your patients throughout your core hours. That's a key wording that I know some places are really frustrated with, because keeping the online consultations open throughout the whole core hours, many practices are overburdened with the number of requests that are coming through and actually like to switch it off because they just can't cope from a safety perspective. And it is at odds with the safe working practices by the BMA to some degree. But also, you have to have the relevant data notice to show that you're capturing that information. So that's another 23,000 roughly, if you were to achieve those for all of your practices. And then the final one is faster care navigation and assessment response. And this is based around appropriate care navigation so that there is no disparity between online requests, telephone requests, and face-to-face requests for patient access and stuff as a result of that. So important to remember that that is one of the key criteria for that part. And then also there's something about continuity that they're going to bring in. Now, myself and Andy covered this in the original contract review, that they were bringing a line of continuity into the contract. We haven't seen the terms of that, but that's where the care navigation response part may come into play. So those are the three criteria for the capacity and access improvement plan. Again, this is based on your clinical director saying that the practices have achieved this. And once they've done that, the payment will be made. There is an audit process that's going to happen at some point for some networks. They haven't identified when or how that will work, but important to be aware of the fact that that's the confirmation process. And Andy's just hovered over the 70% criteria that you have to
do. I was going to ask Andy, so because this can be used quite flexibly, so what would a practice be doing to sort of indicate it's paid anyway, isn't it? Or it's paid up front and can be used flexibly to support a number of activities. But what sort of things would a practice or PCN need to be doing to kind of indicate that they deserve the 70%?
So I think there will be a reconciliation report that probably the clinical directors will have to send back to each of the ICBs to say this is what our practice is doing to manage the capacity and access support payment. So what are you doing to enhance access to your patients? You know, have you looked at any data tools or, you know, other types of data to understand the management of flow and demand within your practices? And then also there's whether or not your practice or your network is engaging in things like the GPIP program. So the general practice, improvement program, that was it.
Yeah.
And other similar things as well. So there are various different things that you can look at in order to do that. I don't think there's a set route or way of doing that as a result of it, but it is very much around using data and equivalating that. I think different places will come up with different documents effectively. but I wouldn't be surprised if this basically just fits along to the modern general practice document, because that's what it did last year, effectively.
It feels there's more flexibility for that, which is welcome.
So that's the capacity and access improvement plans. If we just scroll down a little bit further, there was the IIF.
I was going to go to the contents and jump down that way. So should we go to the tables, Gandhi? Or was there anything in the blurb that you wanted to?
IIF is fairly simple, to be honest. Yeah. The key thing just to be aware of it is that the criteria have reduced. So there's now only two IIF indicators. In total, this is 58 points, of which each point is now £198, aside from adjustments based on prevalence and other kind of things. So it may be slightly different as a result. Of which 36 points was for learning disability reviews in patients over the age of 14. And then 22 points was for cancer referrals. And so specifically for the CAN02, which is lower GI referrals accompanied by a fit test. And I think the reason why they kept this is one of the only initiatives they found that's actually reduced outpatient attendance and picked up more cancers as a result of it. So it's one of the only actual IIF criteria that's had a significant impact in terms of patient care and outpatient numbers as a result of it. So that's why they've kept this particular one in. I think the learning disabilities one is an absolutely sensible one to keep in. But the flu-based ones, the other kind of IIF criteria, that they've rolled those out because they felt that they weren't as significant, which is interesting.
Yeah, and as you say, it's really simplified things from what IIF looked like it was going to be a few years ago, which looked really, really complicated. So I think this is one of the things that is really quite welcome in terms of changes to the contract this year.
It has also included personal care adjustments into the IIF criteria. So if you've got patients for some reason can't do a fit test, you can now add those in, which is a new change. So interesting to be aware of that.
Just wondering if we just so we have a look at what annex there isn't an annex B here, so I thought this was where Christina was referring to.
So it was 7.2.1.
So that's good. Seven.
So just to remind everyone, this was a comment put earlier by Christina. Yeah. Annex B 7.21 maximum entitlements. So she's saying that we'll be notified of our maximum entitlement and what we can have. I mean, most networks are told of what they're allowable. I think the key thing is that there's no significant increase in this. It's a 2% drift increase based on inflation, which is basically, I think that's meant to cover pay increases for this financial year, which may be interesting for a lot of our PCN staff when they find out that they've only going to be giving them a 2% increase because that's all the funding allows. But
and a lot of these roles were originally kind of pitched at Agenda for Change sort of pay scales, but they'll not be getting similar pay increases to people on Agenda for Change in other parts of the NHS, I think, which might be confusing to some people who I've heard some conversations where people have felt that they are on Agenda for Change, but they're not. They just started a role whose initial sort of salary or banding was aligned with Agenda for Change, but the role is not on Agenda for Change. So some awkward conversations potentially to be had. Shall we move on to QoF, Gandhi?
Yeah, so I guess just
reflections on this. We've had some comments.
We've had some more comments. I think most of them are around the questions that we've had before. Christine has put another one. Anyone got creative ways to meet the online consultations throughout core hours requirements? Concerned about this? I think...
How are you doing it?
We offer online consultations to our patients. It's not something that, unfortunately, they seem to use in great deal, which is a bit more of a challenge. I would love them to do that, and we're probably looking at how we can encourage patients to do that. My recommendation would absolutely be to go through things like the NHS app. Also, there's some really cool tools out there to help you do things like that. I think a lot of the telephony providers will be providing, you know, chatbots and that kind of stuff to help you do those kind of things. I talked about EDAT being a cool tool to help with engaging patients with the NHS app as well. I think there's a variety of different things out there that people can look at to help with online consultations. I think the issue of keeping it open throughout the entire time practices are open. I think there is something about being honest to patients as to the capacity the practices have to deal with those requests, and it may be that you have to increase the time frame that you respond to them. So instead of using it for acute demand, you have one route that's acute demand, one route that's routine demand.
Modern general practice says same day, though, doesn't it? That's the thing.
You have to give a response.
It's some sort of response, even if it's a we are dealing with your query. You know, but you've got to risk stratify it at least before you bounce something like that back, I guess. What we're doing, which sounds like it's similar to Francis, what Francis is doing, is we've made it part of the junior doctor's role and allocated the junior doctor some time at the beginning of the day, because we did an audit, and actually that's when the highest numbers per hour of e-consultations come in, at the beginning of the day, and then they drop off. But actually you've had about half of them come in sort of before 10, 11 o'clock, but then actually the other half come in before 5 o'clock, you know, and a few come in after five. So we've allocated some more time for the on-call doctor to do them at the end of the day as well, sort of being driven by that data from our audit. And of course they come up to about 6:30, and actually those that come in at about six and need some can't be directed to an urgent care provider because they're not that bad, but need some input from us. And actually very few are seeming to fall into that gray area, which is reassuring. But that on-call doctor can find themselves in a sort of sticky spot, you know, not having the capacity or resources to deal with things properly. But most of the time people can have a response indicating that they'll get some input the next day or be directed to an urgent care provider. So we're actually finding that's less difficult than we anticipated. That's our experience.
Yep. And Anish commenting, we have ours open from 8 to 6, pretty much core. Majority of the ones you get are before 11 a.m. and that the evening ones tend to be more admin related as well. So interesting point there. Mons Huck, there are proactive care codes at the bottom of Part A. Is this new related to inequalities? I don't remember what they were, to be honest. So we might have a look at that separately, if that's all right, Mons. But we can have a look at that later, if that's okay. So just before we go to Quaff, I'm just going to share something with you that I created in anticipation for this stream. So please watch this for a second.
So subscribe, make sure you click all the notifications, as well as the notify me for the video. It'd be great if you could like it. Share it with your colleagues. And then if you want to see more details, click on more down below.
And I'm specifically sharing that because we are going to look at the Quaff documents, which you may want to follow across with. So the links to the Quaff document is actually down in the YouTube show notes and stuff, along with the links to all the container letters that we've been talking about in this stream already. And I showed Andy that just before we went live, and he was like, when are you going to play that, Gandhi? And then we did.
So it's very good. Ring that bell.
Yeah. Please do. I mean, that's just so that you get aware of all the stuff when we go live and things, because we have changed our schedules a little bit in the past couple of weeks just because of things like Ramadan and stuff. And hopefully that means you can get access to everything as we go along. Anyway, like we said, let's get cracking and talk about Quaff. So there are some changes, quite some significant changes to Quaff for this financial year, and we're going to talk about those now. I am aware we're an hour through already, so we're going to try and do this as quickly as we can, aren't we, Andy?
Yeah, focus on changes, I guess.
Cool. So if you zoom in a little bit, first of all, the helpful thing with this is that NHS England have basically made all the changes to the Quaff document yellow, so you can find all the key changes and stuff. And unfortunately, there's a lot of yellow on this document. However, there is a reason for that, and a really simple reason for that as well. Any ideas why that might be, Andy?
What, why they've made the changes yellow, or
no, why there's quite a lot of yellow?
There's been a lot of changes. I'm not quite sure what you're driving at, Gandhi. What are you driving at?
The main reason why there is actually quite a lot of yellow and suggestion of a lot of changes is because they have basically frozen a lot of the indicators. And as a result of that, there's quite a lot of stuff in here. So the problem with that is it makes reading the whole document a little bit noisy as a result of it and stuff. But effectively, most of the changes are not really changes. It's just telling you that it's been frozen as a result of it. And it's identifying that the particularly the register based stuff, of which I think was 33 in total, I want to say. Best place to go, Andy, is section 2.1 on page 6.
Protected.
Okay. Yeah. So this talks about the income protection that we've got. So 212 points out of the 568, I want to say, are now income protected. Am I right with that? Yeah. Someone's going to tell me I'm wrong there.
I think so.
Yeah. So what does income protection mean? Well, this extends from previous income protection. Last year, some of these indicators were protected. They've increased that, as we said, to 32 total indicators. In terms of income protection, what it means is that whatever you've achieved in 23-24, that's what you'll be paid for 24-25. So that could be a pro, that could be a con as well. So if you did nothing, potentially that's a pro, although you still have to upkeep the registers, because the registers helps to include the prevalence, which then has an impact on the prevalence payment that enhances the amount that you get. However, if you to significantly increase achievement in some of the COF domains and stuff, then that won't be paid for extra. So it's a swings and roundabouts kind of situation, isn't it, Andy?
Mm-hmm. I'm with you. I'm following.
Okay. The other thing to remember, and this is where I think a lot of practice managers and business managers will be focusing on, that even though it says it's protected, that doesn't mean you'll get the same amount as last year. What it does mean is the level has been protected. So again, if your prevalence levels or list size changes, that will affect the actual payment you get. So it may still be different, but the level of payment should be similar or identical. It also mentions in this section what happens if you merge with a practice or if you lose patients, you know, close a practice, etc. Effectively, they'll try and adjust it as best as they can, and they will offer the higher payment depending on which one that is, outside of local situations, which they will then probably have to speak to your ICB about if it's more complicated than that. And that's about it in terms of the income protection side of things. There are, however, some changes worth noting for. So they have included QAF codes for ambulatory blood pressure in the BP reading ones. So that's become more relevant for the hypertension ones. So that is somewhere in there about ambulatory blood pressure readings now being incorporated in terms of the QAF guidance. And then the biggest change is actually, I believe, cholesterol management ones, Andy. Sorry, I'm getting you to jump around, aren't I?
You are. You've got your own separate notes here, Gandhi. So.
I have, yeah. I basically looked at this whilst Andy was doing the PCNDES ones in more detail and stuff. So, yeah, the cholesterol management ones. This is probably where there's the biggest amount of yellow stuff. So what they've done is they changed COL1 and COL2 to COL3 and COL4. Effectively, I'm not quite sure why they've changed the numbers of them, but I guess it's because they made a significant change, the biggest one being on COL04. Which now it allows for the inclusion of LDL cholesterol levels, because some places didn't have non-HDL levels. And also they've changed the relevant criteria to being 2.0, which is a slight increase from 1.8, which is what it was last year. And that's to bring it more in line with the NICE guidance in terms of achievement. Mm. I believe the level of achievement rates has not changed. So COL3 is still 70 to 85% for the achievement points, and COL4 is 20 to 35% in terms of achievements and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that is pretty much it, to be honest. Like I said, there wasn't any major other changes when it came to QAF on a significant level. They have income protected the QAF QI. So they have stated that you don't have to do the QAF QI, although they would encourage you to still do QI as a process within the practices. And most of the other changes that go through are just nomenclature changes or changes to state that it's been protected or just changes in terms of terms and stuff. The depression monitoring is included in that income protection. So the requirement to review patients 2 to 8 weeks after initiation of a diagnosis of depression is not something that will be QAF managed any further. But obviously from a safety perspective, they would still recommend that you do that. And I would highly recommend that you still do that, because it's depending on the patient's risks and stuff and things. But just those are some of the extra non register based ones that have been included in the QAF and things.
Mm.
Does that help, Andy?
It does. It's one of those where I'm going to still need to spend some more time just sort of digesting the changes. The main contact I have with Quaff is in the is actually within System One, you know, and so it may be that I have to really see it there to fully understand the changes. Of course, they don't update for often a few months into the year,
yep.
Which is always really, really difficult. So, yeah. We got through Quaff a bit quicker than I was planning, Andy, or than I was anticipating.
I think it reflects the fact that there haven't been, although there have been some changes and some potentially quite useful ones as well, it's not been as far-reaching as I think people were originally worried about and stuff.
It's more the income protection, isn't it? That was the biggest bit. Does one of these tables indicate, or just all of those that are income protected together? Is that?
It's in table, more, yeah. It, yeah, there is a section that shows it. I think that's it, yeah.
I think this is the table, isn't it? So, because as ever with these documents, I tend to try and scan through for the tables in terms of finding the most useful information summarized from the document. So I think we think that these are the paused indicators here. It's in the pause indicator section.
So pages 8, 9, 10 and 11. And then the clinical domain ones includes as well is on 11, 12 and 13, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah. Good. So, right. What are your overall impressions, Gandhi, in terms of contract changes, either and core contract and PCN, DES? We had some initial responses last time, didn't we? It sat with us for a while and we've had a closer look at the contracts. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the key thing is there are some reconciliation changes that I think are useful from a bureaucratic point of view. I think that, you know, the income protection for Quaff is somewhat a benefit. I think it does raise the question, what happens if you manage more and the fact that you'll be penalised by if you do better? I don't like that prospect, but I guess it's the only way that NHS England felt that they could manage the whole thing to make it fairer to everybody else. I think there is something to recognise, though, but because people's attention may not be on as much as Quaff, what will that mean in the following year? Because I know in some places where they've had income protection for Quaff in previous years, because they've not focused as much on having to keep the registers and everything else up, now that they're being income protected this year, they're actually going to get less than they would have done if they'd still kept it up, if that makes sense.
Yeah, if the indicators are coming back, you still need to maintain the systems and processes within the practice that you use to achieve them, don't you? And if you let those degrade, then you're not going to be able to achieve them in the future. So I think pausing is helpful where there's kind of perhaps factors outside of the practice which are going to affect achievement. So the pandemic was a really, really good example, you know, of where pausing, I think, was helpful to protect practice income. But if you're just pausing them with the prospect of them coming back, people will still have to do that work to maintain the ability to be able to achieve the indicators in the future. So I think it is helpful, but I don't think we're dealing with sort of population factors that are preventing the achievement. I think what we're trying to control are pressures on and within organizations at achieving the outcomes. And I'm not sure that pausing is the best way to do that, although I think it is helpful.
I think in terms of the PCN DES contract, so we've seen some changes. Obviously, the main focus is now on modern general practice and the CAPE funding to focus a lot of that. The reconciliation, I think, of the DES outcomes themselves, somewhat nicer. I'd be interested to know what the reporting mechanism for that will look like, because I'm sure we'll be told at some point, or instructed or demanded, shall we say, in terms of what to do. I think the GP contract we talked about in great depth in terms of some of the other changes that have come through. Obviously, the fact that the 2% increase is just really poor.
That's the headline, isn't it? I think,
yeah.
Because other things within both of these contracts are actually fairly sensible and not that much different from what's happened in years before. But it's just that the core contract funding increase is just insufficient to cover rising core costs, and that's the headline, and there's no getting around that, really. I think perhaps NHS England have tried to be quite creative within the cost envelope that the government may have given them, but the cost envelope just ain't right, really. and needs to be more if people are expecting the same level of care to continue in an environment where the cost of providing a certain level of care is going up and the funding isn't going up to match it. Yeah, I guess my overall impression, Scandia, I think so they've paused some of the QAF indicators, but they have reduced the number of IIF indicators and made that simpler. And it's a lot simpler than it was looking a few years ago when that first came down. So I think they are trying to cut kind of that bureaucracy for primary care networks and practices. They've been clearer and simplified some of the way that the cash flows, I guess, in terms of combining a few pots with primary care networks to allow some more flexibility. And it's clearer that the CAPE funding will flow, the 30% will flow throughout the year once you meet those criteria. There is more flexibility in terms of how you can use your R staff. They've reduced the caps. They've brought in the enhanced nurse role, not enhanced GPs or whatever they might have done to allow GPs to be provided as additional workforce. They haven't done that, but there is more flexibility around how you use that R's money, and maybe that sets a direction of travel for even more flexibility next year, which I think would be welcome. I'm probably running dry there, but there are some positives, but I think it's just that the headline funding isn't sufficient, really. Have we had a few more comments from people?
So from a random Facebook user, we've had a comment about are the cholesterol indicators allowing for patients with frailty? Do we need to add personalized care adjustments for those patients where aggressive lipid lowering is not indicated? As I said, they have included personalized care adjustments in the cholesterol QAF this year. So maybe worth having a look at those in more detail to see what that means to your population and stuff. But I think there is some inclusion in there about how aggressive you need to be and if it's appropriate to do so. Similar how there is, I guess, for the blood pressure one in terms of them being on maximum tolerated therapy, maybe the right way to think about it. Francis, again, does anyone know anything fancy with registers like osteoporosis, rheumatoid arthritis? I get my SPLWs to send texts and links with local information, charities and support. I think that's quite a sensible thing to do, using the PCN roles to support the way that you signpost patients to various different services and things. I don't know if there's anything else you can think of, Andy.
I mean, there's all sorts of things that you could do. Personally, we're not doing things like what have been suggested for those population groups. I mean, what we have started doing is sending sort of targeted texts to, not quite the same thing, but to say people who haven't seen the GP for 2 years, and we don't have an up-to-date blood pressure reading. Saying actually we're running an event, at the local Tesco's in the local market, maybe come along there, and we're having some success there with that sort of targeting. So not quite a QAF registers, but defining sort of population health led groups to get people in and do specific things with. So
cool. Okay, we've had a question from Joseph Hopkins. Can I just go back to CAPE and the OC? We would drown if we opened them up from 4 core hours. Presumably, we just decide to forego that 10% of the 30% if we choose to. Yes, there's a simple answer to that. So if you can't say that you can do that, you still have the other option of going for the other two aspects of the 30%. So you still get 20%. So if you're 50,000 patient population, you still get 46,000 of the CAPE. The local...
Local
something fun.
It doesn't have an L in it. It's got it should have an L in the acronym, but it doesn't. I hadn't really thought about it like that, actually, that it allows you to selectively not do things but still achieve some of the funding. So that's interesting. And I guess it depends on where Joseph is sat as well, because if you're a practice, then I guess that means if you don't do it and the other practice in the primary care network do, they can't get their 10% funding either, because it has to be everyone within the primary care network. So how you feel about that question probably depends on where you're sat within the primary care network.
Well, I think it could make for very interesting primary network meetings, because like you said, if there was one practice that felt they didn't want to do online consultations for that reason and the others did, then they're potentially stopping that network from having funding, and how that discussion would go would be, well, an interesting one for the PCN clinical director to navigate and stuff and things. So
yeah, I guess it's part of what will be an intention of primary care networks to reduce variability of of experience of access and other elements of the service across primary care networks. And I guess it's beginning to do that, I suppose.
Zahn's come with a couple of points. Number one, what does an enhanced nurse mean? So we did cover this earlier, so feel free to go have a look back. But effectively, you've got your practice nurse, you've got your ANP, and it's somewhere in the middle that focuses on specific clinical things. And then he comes back with another one about essentially the incentive structure should also be along for long-term multi-morbid clinics. As we mentioned, there is something written into the contract about continuity. They haven't outlined what that will look like and how that will be assessed yet. So whether that will have an impact in terms of long-term multi-morbid clinics and the use of them and stuff is a possibility, I guess. But yeah, worth bearing that in mind. And then Anish, are you not drowning already? Total triage is my snorkel. He has written afterwards that I think it's not. rather than don't and stuff. Which I guess that's the flip side of it. You know, I'm very much of the mind that online consultations can be sometimes more effective because at least it gives you an information capture of what the patient wants. You can navigate that based off the information the patient submitted. So I do think it's safer from that perspective. But you know, it's how you manage it is also part of the challenge.
Although some people would say that the problem is that, you know, you've only got so many spaces in the car park, you know, so many doctors in providing so many appointments safely, and that when you do something like online consultations and open it up to everybody within core hours, you're just sort of putting another ramp that goes into the car park, but you're not increasing the amount of spaces within the car park, and that it actually gets you better access to that car park, but actually in terms of how many people can use it, it doesn't really change that. I've heard people make that argument as well. I think the jury's out really on online consultations and what the actual impact on demand management is.
It does very much vary. I think there's various different models as well you can look at. There's there's the total triage model, and there's various other ones that I think people are looking at and stuff and things. But there are some really good resources out there if you want to have a look. Obviously, we host a lot of them on EGP Learning as well, if you want to have a look on there as well for things. But I think if you do want more information, I guess the question is, where do you look? Well, we've got loads coming for you. There is still time if you want to join us remotely for our PCN Plus conference, which is 10 days? Is
it? 17th of April.
Yeah, so 17th of April. So unfortunately, in person, we are completely booked out, fully booked out, in fact, overbooked out, I think. But if you want to join us remotely, where we'll be talking about this as well with Ben and Ben Gallen from the General Practice Podcast and Tara Humphreys from the Business Healthcare Podcast, then feel free to register for that. It is completely free. So bit.ly/PCNplus24L, all in capitals. If you want to have some slightly different type of fun, then come and join myself and Andy for our GP5T7 conference on the 27th of April, and that's in Nottingham. Alternately, you can join remotely as well, which is what most people tend to do, and that's fine because we've only got about 7 seats left in the actual conference. If you want to come face-to-face with us, and I'm hoping to have some interesting games ready for that session as well, Andy, if I can get them done in time. I'd love to have more people join me for Epic, which is going to be released shortly after Ramadan and stuff. So interesting implementation consultations with fellow GPs. So bit.ly/Epic apply. You can absolutely get some more details on how to apply and stuff through that link and stuff. And I guess the question is, what are we doing next time? Well, I'm sure there'll be something else coming through because we're not actually quite sure.
I think it'll be a news update next time. So. And that there's bound to be something happening around contracts, industrial action, never a dull moment. Same day access hubs popping up somewhere else, and all sorts tends to happen, doesn't it?
So I'm going to answer Zalan's question. So will you two be charging for autographs? No, we don't charge for autographs. So don't worry if you do want to come join us.
I would be delighted if someone asked me for an autograph. Can we bring up Anish's comment? So just going back to the car park, disabled spots only. Everyone else needs to take the train away from the practice.
So I like that.
To another level.
We need to come up with a better way of describing that analogy. I think that could be quite a cool episode, to be honest, and stuff. But hey ho. So if you have found this episode useful, make sure you leave a review on whichever podcasting platform you're listening to us on, whether that's Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or another platform. Definitely let us know what you want to do. And if there's other content you'd like us to cover, alternately, you can apply for Epic. So that's bit.ly/Epic. Apply, the Epic, E-P-I-C being in capitals. I would love to have you on the podcast, as we will be starting those shortly. And reminder, those are podcast listener only episodes, so you get them, nobody else does. As always, let us know what you think, and we'll catch you soon.
Oh, hello there, EGP learner. I'm Dr. Gandalf, and I often get asked, what kind of resources do you have to try and help those using EMIS? Because you tend to do a lot more stuff for System 1. And often I've really struggled to answer that question because, let's be honest, I don't use EMIS on a regular basis. So therefore, trying to help EMIS users is a little bit more difficult for myself. And that really made me feel, well, not great. So I kind of did something to try and help all those EMIS users out there. I went and had a chat with one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike from GP on the Move, and him and I have created a course that you can use to help you use EMIS so much better. That's right, if you use EMIS, but you want to use it so much better, so much quicker, and in such a way that means you go home sooner, then check out our EMIS for Clinicians course. It's an online course that takes you through all the tips and tricks that Dr. Mike knows to try and basically mean you can go home quicker. That'd be a cool thing, wouldn't it? And guess what? It's currently on offer. So if you want to take advantage of this introductory offer and get access to it now, look at the links down below and check it out. Additionally, if you're a practice, network, or wide area that wants more opportunity to use it, send me an email, egplearning@gmail.com. Let's see if we can help you out. And as I like to say, tech enhance your primary care and learning. Shall we get back to it? Oh, and if you wanted one for System 1 users, well, you know I've got you covered, haven't I? Check out the Learn System 1 for Clinicians course, bit.ly/TPP S1 course.